the hits.
Come on, Harry.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, you will hear stories from Dan Friedel and Gregory Stockel. Faith Perlow tells us more about hyphens in this week's Ask a Teacher. We close with the American story, The Birthmark, by Nathaniel Hawthorne. But first, a 14-year-old student from San Antonio, Texas, has won the Scripps National Spelling Bee on her fourth attempt. Harini Logan's victory came late Thursday in the first-ever spell-off tiebreaker of the competition. Logan spelled 21 words correctly during the 90-second spell-off. That was six more than her opponent, 12-year-old Vikram Raju of Aurora, Colorado. The judges said the winning word was moorhen, which means a female red grouse bird. Logan's victory came after it appeared that she had answered a question incorrectly during the vocabulary round of the spelling bee, but she was soon reinstated. She defined the word pollulation as the nesting of mating birds, but the judges said the correct answer was the swarming of bees. My heart stopped for a second, Harini said. A few minutes later, head judge Mary Brooks said the judges studied the word and her answer. They decided to change their decision. The answer you gave to that word is considered correct, so we are going to reinstate you. Grace Walters has trained Logan in spelling for some time. She said, Harini has been to hell and back with her spelling bee experiences. Harini said she was afraid when the spell-off was introduced last year, saying, I go slow. That's my thing. I didn't know how I would fare in that setting. Over the past few months, Harini prepared for the possibility of a spell-off. And on Thursday, Harini won the $50,000 in prizes. She is the first ever spelling bee champion to have been reinstated during the competition. The Scripps National Spelling Bee takes place in Washington, D.C. It has been held since 1925. Vikram Raju came in second. He said, I just had to be a little faster. He hopes to return next year. The spelling bee returned to in-person competition this year after being held mostly online last year. In the end, it's all been worth it, Walters said. This is the ending Harini deserves.
A resort in Vietnam has opened a glass-bottomed footbridge connecting two mountains. It is the third such bridge in the Southeast Asian country. The 150-meter-tall bridge crosses a deep, narrow area called a gorge. The aim of the bridge is to bring in thrill-seeking tourists. The bridge is called the Bạc Long Suspension Bridge. It means white dragon in Vietnamese. A dragon is a huge imaginary flying animal that can breathe out fire and looks like a reptile. The bridge is found in the Son Lai area. Son Lai is northwest of the capital, Hanoi, and borders Laos. The opening ceremony included dragon dancing and a ribbon cutting. VT2 is a 22-year-old visitor who attended the ceremony and walked on the bridge. "I dared not look down as I am afraid of heights," she said. "I imagined in my head what would happen if I fell through." The reinforced glass used for the bridge can hold up to 450 people at a time. Each glass piece used for the bridge is 40 millimeters thick. The bridge is 290 meters long and runs between two mountaintops on either side of a gorge. It also has a 342-meter pathway on the side of a mountain. Guinness World Records keeps a list of world records. It lists a 562-meter glass-bottom bridge in Qingyuan in China's Guangdong area as the world's longest. The World Record Association is another organization that keeps a list of world records. It listed the two-part Vietnamese bridge as the world's longest at 632 meters. Chun Suan Ting is 72 years old and a visitor to the bridge. He seemed happy he walked on the bridge. He said he was frightened at first, but added, "If you walked over around 10 glass panels, that feeling is gone." I'm Gregory Stockel.
A famous cheese-rolling race that takes place on a steep hill in England returns on Sunday after a two-year delay caused by the coronavirus pandemic. The event is held in the town of Brockworth. It was first recorded in 1826. It involves competitors chasing a 4-kilogram round of double Gloucester cheese down a 200-meter hill. The rolling cheese reaches speeds of 100 kilometers per hour. The first person to make it down the hill is the winner. Most of the cheese chasers fly head over heels down the hill. Members of the local rugby team wait at the bottom as catchers to help people slow down. Emergency medical workers are nearby in case of serious injuries. Some people say the event is too dangerous because of the number of injuries people receive. The event is now famous as an extreme sport. It has been broadcast on television around the world. Thousands of people who want to watch make the trip to Brockworth, which is about 160 kilometers west of London. Max McDougall lives nearby. He was the winner in 2019. He was not able to defend his championship the following year because of the pandemic. This year, there are three men's races, a women's race, and a safe children's race, which is an uphill run. At the end, the winner gets to eat the special prize, a huge piece of cheese. I'm Dan Friedel.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we will continue to answer a question from Yusra from Egypt about using hyphens when making compound nouns. Hello, my name is Yusra from Egypt. I would like to know when I should use a hyphen between two words like top selling or well-being. Thanks. Dear Yusra, thank you for your question. In this week's program, we will learn some general rules for creating compound nouns with hyphens. In last week's program, we talked about using hyphens to create a compound adjective. For example, top selling, meaning having the most sales. A hyphen is used to combine two or more words together. A compound noun is two or more nouns combined to create a single noun expression. While we write most compound nouns as one word, raindrop, or two separate words, high school, some compound nouns use a hyphen. For example, well-being, or the state of being happy, healthy, or successful. We use hyphens with compound nouns so that the sentence is clear and understandable. Just like compound adjectives, you can create compound nouns from adjectives, verbs, adverbs, and other nouns. 1. When combining a verb and an adverb to create a compound noun, use a hyphen. The hyphen connects the adverb to the verb and not another word in the sentence. For example, let's look at the compound noun takeout. It means food you order from a restaurant to pick up and take with you. Every Friday night, I love getting takeout from my favorite Middle Eastern restaurant. 2. A hyphen is required for compound nouns made from two nouns. These types of nouns act as a unit, like in these examples, English speakers or hunter-gatherer. There are over 1.5 billion English speakers in the world. There are many hunter-gatherer societies today that still depend on the natural environment for food. 3. Always check your dictionary if you are unsure if a compound noun requires a hyphen. There are many exceptions to these rules. And sometimes, a word that once required a hyphen changes over time to become a one-word compound or a two-word compound. Please let us know if these rules, explanations, and examples have helped you, Yusra. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Faith Perlow.
Our story today is called The Birthmark. It was written by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Here is Barbara Klein with the story.
A long time ago, there lived a skillful scientist who had experienced a spiritual reaction more striking than any chemical one. He had left his laboratory in the care of his assistant, washed the chemicals from his hands, and asked a beautiful woman to become his wife. In those days, new scientific discoveries, such as electricity, seemed to open paths into the area of miracles. It was not unusual for the love of science to compete with the love of a woman. The scientist's name was Aylmer. He had so totally given himself to scientific studies that he could not be weakened by a second love. His love for his young wife could only be the stronger of the two if it could link itself with his love of science. Such a union did take place, with truly remarkable results. But one day, very soon after their marriage, Aylmer looked at his wife with a troubled expression. "Georgiana," he said, "have you ever considered that the mark upon your cheek might be removed?" "No," she said, smiling. But seeing the seriousness of his question, she said, "The mark has so often been called a charm that I was simple enough to imagine it might be so." "On another face it might," answered her husband, "but not on yours. No, dear. Nature made you so perfectly that this small defect shocks me as being a sign of earthly imperfection." "Shocks you?" cried Georgiana, deeply hurt. Her face reddened, and she burst into tears. "Then why did you marry me? You cannot love what shocks you." We must explain that in the center of Georgiana's left cheek, there was a mark deep in her skin. The mark was usually a deep red color. When Georgiana blushed, the mark became less visible. But when she turned pale, there was the mark, like a red stain upon snow. The birthmark would come and go with the emotions in her heart. The mark was shaped like a very small human hand. Georgiana's past lovers used to say that the hand of a magical fairy had touched her face when she was born. Many a gentleman would have risked his life for the honor of kissing that mysterious hand. But other people had different opinions. Some women said the red hand quite destroyed the effect of Georgiana's beauty. Male observers who did not praise the mark simply wished it away so that they did not see it. After his marriage, Aylmer discovered that this was the case with himself. Had Georgiana been less beautiful, he might have felt his love increased by the prettiness of that little hand. But because she was otherwise so perfect, he found the mark had become unbearable. Aylmer saw the mark as a sign of his wife's eventual sadness sickness, and death. Soon, the birthmark caused him more pain than Georgiana's beauty had ever given him pleasure. During a period that should have been their happiest, Aylmer could only think of this disastrous subject. With the morning light, Aylmer opened his eyes upon his wife's face and recognized the sign of imperfection. When they sat together in the evening near the fire, he would look at the mark. Georgiana soon began to fear his look. His expression would make her face go pale, and the birthmark would stand out like a red jewel on white stone. "Do you remember, dear Aylmer, about the dream you had last night about this hateful mark?" she asked with a weak smile.
"None, none whatever," answered Aylmer, surprised.
The mind is in a sad state when sleep cannot control its ghosts and allows them to break free with their secrets. Aylmer now remembered his dream. He had imagined himself with his assistant, Aminadab, trying to remove the birthmark with an operation. But the deeper his knife went, the deeper the small hand sank until it had caught hold of Georgiana's heart. Aylmer felt guilty remembering the dream. "Aylmer," said Georgiana, "I do not know what the cost would be to both of us to remove this birthmark. Removing it could deform my face or damage my health."
"Dearest Georgiana, I have spent much thought on the subject," said Aylmer. "I am sure it can be removed."
"Then let the attempt be made at any risk," said Georgiana. "Life is not worth living while this hateful mark makes me the object of your horror. You have deep science and have made great discoveries. Remove this little mark for the sake of your peace and my own."
"Dearest wife," cried Aylmer, "do not doubt my power. I am ready to make this cheek as perfect as its pair."
Her husband gently kissed her right cheek, the one without the red hand. The next day, the couple went to Aylmer's laboratory, where he had made all his famous discoveries. Georgiana would live in a beautiful room he had prepared nearby, while he worked tirelessly in his lab. One by one, Aylmer tried a series of powerful experiments on his wife, but the mark remained. Georgiana waited in her room. She read through his notebooks of scientific observations. She could not help see that many of his experiments had ended in failure. She decided to see for herself the scientist at work. The first thing that struck Georgiana when entering the laboratory was the hot furnace. From the amount of soot above it, it seemed to have been burning for ages. She saw machines, tubes, cylinders, and other containers for chemical experiments. What most drew her attention was Aylmer himself. He was nervous and pale as death as he worked on preparing a liquid. Georgiana realized that her husband had been hiding his tension and fear. "Think not so little of me that you cannot be honest about the risks we are taking," she said. "I will drink whatever you make for me, even if it is a poison."
"My dear, nothing shall be hidden," Aylmer said. "I have already given you chemicals powerful enough to change your entire physical system. Only one thing remains to be tried, and if that fails, we are ruined."
He led her back to her room, where she waited once more, alone with her thoughts. She hoped that for just one moment she could satisfy her husband's highest ideals, but she realized then that his mind would forever be on the march, always requiring something newer, better, and more perfect. Hours later, Aylmer returned carrying a crystal glass with a colorless liquid.
"The chemical process went perfectly," he said. "Unless all my science has tricked me, it cannot fail."
To test the liquid, he placed a drop in the soil of a dying flower growing in a pot in the room. In a few moments, the plant became healthy and green once more.
"I do not need proof," Georgiana said quietly. "Give me the glass. I'm happy to put my life in your hands."
She drank the liquid and immediately fell asleep. Aylmer sat next to his wife, observing her and taking notes. He noted everything: her breathing, the movement of an eyelid. He stared at the birthmark. And slowly, with every breath that came and went, it lost some of its brightness.
"By heaven, it's nearly gone," said Aylmer. "Success! Success!"
He opened the window coverings to see her face in daylight. She was so pale. Georgiana opened her eyes and looked into the mirror her husband held. She tried to smile as she saw the barely visible mark.
"My poor Aylmer," she said gently. "You have aimed so high, with so high and pure a feeling. You have rejected the best the earth could offer. I am dying, dearest."
It was true. The hand on her face had been her link to life. As the last trace of color disappeared from her cheek, she gave her last breath. Blinded by a meaningless imperfection and an impossible goal, Aylmer had thrown away her life, and with it, his chance for happiness. In trying to improve his lovely wife, he had failed to realize she had been perfect all along.
The Birthmark was written by Nathaniel Hawthorne. It was adapted and produced by Dana Demange. Your storyteller was Barbara Klein.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.